Support for Juno Afternoon comes from Alaska Airlines Club 49. Membership information available at club49hub.com. Toxic Newsome, Salama, thank you and welcome to Juno Afternoon from community-supported KTOO. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. You can also join us via our live stream on KTOO's YouTube or Facebook page. Today, Friday, January 16th, 2026. Next week begins the second session of the 34th Alaska Legislature. We talk with Alaska Public Media's Eric Stone to get a preview of what's to come, and we'll feature the first in a series of interviews from morning host Mike Lane talking with Juno's delegation. Today, Mike chats with Senator Jesse Keel. A marimba workshop taking place over the next 3 days will culminate in a performance this Sunday, January 18th at Perseverance Theater. It's going to be a fundraiser for an arts and culture center in Zimbabwe. And we begin today by welcoming to the studio the co-curators of an exhibit opening next week at On Hit, Tlingit and Haida's cultural and economic hub in downtown Juneau. The show is called Gestures of Our Rebel Bodies and features Indigenous artists from across the Northwest Coast and explores how embodied practice, movement, material knowledge, and creative speculation function as engines of cultural continuity and future making. We'll talk about all the featured artists, but some names you might recognize: Jennifer Younger, Nicholas Galanin, Allison Bremer, and two of the other artists featured in the show and serving as those co-curators are Ursula Hudson and Kimberly Fulton Orozco. Gunath Chish, Hayedi, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to have you here. Gunath Chish, Wasiati, Ursula, how are you?
Hi, I'm doing really well. Karius ne dechat duasak, tak dentan, ayahat, kashai hedi dach. Thank you for having us, Boston.
Absolutely. And hawa to you. How are you, Kimberly?
Doing great. Happy to be here. Sandlanai hinu had kich di kia ang, gayalist gust udi kwelagang. Yakchinas Udi Ijung.
Oh, I love that. That's a little bit of Haida.
I'm Kimberly Fulton Orozco. My Haida name is Sandlanai, and I'm happy to be here.
Excellent. Okay, well, we'll get into talking to you both about your own specific work, because I'm really curious about all of that. But you're co-curators of this exhibit, Gestures of Our Rebel Bodies. So how did this... What's the seed of where this show began? Who wants to talk about that?
Well, I mean, I guess I'll just be super honest and transparent about the whole process. Jarek Hope Lang,
yes,
who is the buyer of art over at On Hit, kind of a magic maker over there, he invited me to do a solo show. Mm. And I live in Colorado, and I was like, I can't produce enough work in time or bring all that work up to Juneau from Colorado to fill that entire upstairs space. So I called up Kimberly, who I had just graduated from the Institute of American Indian Arts with this past spring. And her and I have very similar artistic practices and philosophies on art making. We're both what they would call displaced Northwest Coast artists. And
what does that mean, displaced Northwest Coast artists? What do you mean by that?
We did not grow up within our Indigenous cultures.
Okay, great.
Or on our homelands.
Okay, gotcha. Okay, good.
So I called her up. I was like, do you want to do this show with me? And she's like, heck yeah. And then we were like, we just want all our friends to be in this show too.
Yeah.
Can we invite, how many friends can we bring in? And then we started working with SHI and the Institute of American Indian Arts, just kind of dreaming up different kinds of what brainstorming what kind of programming we could do. It was just this like giant art project, it turned out to be.
Yeah, and I think a lot of it is centered around self-determination and freedom of expression that is rooted in ancestral knowledge and these really deep foundations of visual practice.
Mm.
And we just continued brainstorming, and the turnaround time was so tight. So we're simultaneously trying to get support around the show and also generate interest from other artists so that we can kind of round out the picture of what we're doing and the breadth of what it means to be rooted in customary knowledge and tradition and connection to culture, but then also not be hemmed in by the strict principles of visual expression.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, for being something that's come together, it sounds like it's been a whirlwind of getting it all together, but it seems pretty awesome so far. Like, this is what's coming. Let me just give an example of what's happening here. So the show is going to open with the reception on Saturday, January 24th, so a week from tomorrow, from 5 to 8 p.m. And that, as you've already mentioned, a few collaborators here. Clinkett Nahida, of course, who runs On Hit, which is the Economic and Cultural Center downtown in Juneau. And you're also working with Sea Alaska Heritage, the Institute of American Indian Arts, and to put all that together. And then all of these awesome artists. I mentioned a couple in the intro. I mentioned Allison Bremner, I mentioned Nicholas Galanin, and I think I mentioned Jennifer Younger. And a lot of people know those folks from their other work. There's Jennifer Younger earrings all over Juneau and the world. But, you know, there's all kinds of wonderful artists there. And in addition to you two, who are some of the other names that you can tell me here that are going to be part of the show?
Pretty much you named them all except Aaron Haldane, who was raised in Anchorage, but then moved down to Santa Fe with her family in high school. She's Tsimshian.
Okay.
And she is going to IAIA, Institute of American Indian Arts, right now in her master's. She's deep in her master's thesis writing right now, I would assume.
almost spring. Yeah, that's got to be going on, right?
And yeah. And she's exploring similar themes to what Kimberly and I have been working through, and her work is just very aligned with the mission of this exhibit and the discussion points, the conversations we want to have around contemporary Native art up here.
And is Jackson also in
the show?
Jackson Paulus is also going to be exhibiting video work. And Jackson is...
Stephen Jackson,
trained from a very young age as a carver, the son of Nathan Jackson, and also a member of New Red Order, which is the art collective that he primarily works under.
Mm.
He was also a mentor to both Ursula and I through IAIA's MFA program.
Oh, cool. Okay.
So there's this really cool kind of lineage that's being expressed through this collaboration also.
Yeah, that's cool. And so that show is going to open, the opening reception will be on Saturday, January 24th. But a couple days prior, Thursday, January 22nd, from noon to 1:30, there's going to be a cool panel of a lot of the artists involved, right? There's going to be a panel talking about ancestral memory, intuition, and embodied knowledge, and how that sort of guides the contemporary indigenous creative practice. I'm reading this from the description, but that covers exactly what it's going to be, which is cool, because this idea that, you know, you're talking about, when you mentioned Ursula, about sort of displaced, and then, so I'm curious about that. Like, did you, I mean, we know, well, maybe people don't know, but Ursula's, your mother, Clarissa Rizal, was a renowned weaver, and you have sort of taken some of that up. And it, how did this, how did it come to you, I guess? Like, in terms of, like, if you're, hadn't grown up with it necessarily, but how did you then find your way to it and end up in an MFA program and all of that?
When you say it, come to it, which,
like
which part?
The artwork, the actual artwork.
Yeah, I was steeped, I was homeschooled, well, unschooled, so my parents didn't have a curriculum. So basically that just meant that I had to sit next to my mom while she worked. And I, whether I liked it or not, I was exposed to regalia making, carving, large installation works. Both my parents were full-time artists working in the Northwest Coast art world. And I just actually couldn't escape it, actually.
Did you have that feeling that some people have, you know, like where it's like you're like a preacher's kid or if you're a musician's kid and you sort of rejected it first?
Oh, yes.
Were you like, I don't want to do that?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Up until I was about 18, I was determined not to be an artist.
You're like, I'm going to become an accountant.
I wanted to be a millionaire, whatever it was.
Yeah.
But now I guess I have to be a billionaire. and then I had to sign up for classes in college, and the only ones I wanted to take were art classes. And that was kind of frustrating. But I, at that time, I knew I did not want to weave because the narrative I'd received all growing up, probably not from within the my native community, was that traditional artwork was not real artwork. It was just mimicry. And so you weren't like really a genius if you were mimicking past work. Or so, for example, in college, if I did any sort of form line on, like, say I carved on a pot, some sort of like an eagle or a raven, my professor was like, that looks like your ancestors' work. You can't do that. So I knew I didn't want to be a weaver because I wanted to be a successful artist. And my mom, you know, she made most of her living teaching how to weave. And I didn't want to teach. I wanted to make art. So it wasn't until she passed in 2016 that I actually started weaving willingly. And I love what comes to you when you're weaving. I love what comes to you, how I refound my connections to myself and my ancestors and my mother and my sister. She's Lily Hope. To coming back here, weaving with other weavers here, it offered me this connection and sense of belonging that I think all of us want. And so at that point, I was no longer going to resist it.
That's such an interesting thought that people, and especially if there's teachers who are thinking that there can't be originality or creative expression inside a traditional art form. You know, like that it's not original or that it's not something that is unique because it feels like it's copying or something like that. I mean, I can't even comprehend how that would be possible. But obviously you experienced it, right? Because people have, you know, it's just so fascinating to me because there is such originality in the work, right? And the images that are created using the it's more like, let's say formline, for example. I mean, I'm not an expert at all, but just from my little that I know, it feels like that's a structure, and then there's such freedom within that structure, right, that you can find in the artwork, as opposed to like, oh, because, I mean, I've seen, I think I just saw one of the shows that on Hit, the Gallery Walk, that Crystal and Rico did. And Rico did this like deck of it's all ravens and stuff, but they're all different, right? And then there's some other artists who do that too. There was an exhibit down at Spice, I can't remember the artist's name right now, but all the different images were ravens, but in different configurations and discombobulated or disembodied raven. It was really cool, right? So that was kind of awesome. What about you, Kimberly? How did it come to you? How did it find you in your life?
Well, I come from a family. My grandmother grew up in Craig, but she was separated from her parents when she was 9 years old. She went to the Wrangell Institute, and then beyond that, just never returned to Southeast Alaska to live.
Mm.
And so really kind of grew up in this space where she learned that her nativeness was something that she needed to hide in order to survive and have the quality of life that she wanted to have.
Mm.
But my uncle and my father were always exploring the artwork and trying to connect to culture through art. They didn't have a like close connection or a real like reference point from within the lineage of traditional practice to access. So Sea Alaska Heritage has actually made a huge difference in their educational offerings and what they have provided to community since COVID.
Mm.
And I think a big part of finding my way into this space has been that Sea Alaska started offering classes online during COVID. And so every class that would come up that I was able to take, I would.
Mm.
And through that, just connected with a lot of people who I understood and started to understand that what I was experiencing as a diasporic Native person was something that a lot of people experienced.
Mm.
And, you know, the connection doesn't go away because of those conditions. And so I ended up coming back to Craig to take my aunt's remains. She wanted to be returned home. And when I was on Prince of Wales Island, just met so many relatives who embraced me as being home, like welcome home. I heard more than I had ever heard in my life, and people reflecting back to me, like knowing my family and who, like where I came from in this way, that just filled me with a sense of belonging that I don't think that I had ever felt anywhere. And it just affirmed that the artwork may be that like tendril that's reaching outward. And there's a way to like continue to build connection through making, through community, through doing activities like this, like building tangible connections with the present through those roots.
Yeah, that's amazing. That's Kimberly Fulton Orozco. I'm talking with her and Ursula Hudson. They are the co-curators of Gestures of Our Rebel Bodies. It's a show that's opening on Saturday, January 24th at On Hit downtown, the gallery space down there that Clinkett and Haida has. And it's got a bunch of artists involved. And I guess I want to ask before I run out of time with y'all, because I could talk forever about this stuff, but the theme of this show, right? I know that Raven's involved and there's some ideas there around that. So what are we going to see from it? Did you like have everyone commission specific work from them, or did you ask them for specific kinds of work around like the idea of Raven, or where are we going with this? What are we going to look at next week?
We asked for work that kind of referenced gesture and expression and self-determination of vision, and wanted people to be freely expressing like who they are and their connection to this place and to their heritage.
And I do want to say something about Raven, who his personality is, he's not worried about messing up.
Mm.
He's going to experiment. He's going to try things, and they might flop. and then he's going to try again. And I think that growing up in this culture, in this American culture, we are discouraged from experimentation. There's just so much fear around art making, and especially within, I think, Northwest Coast art, traditional form line design, there is so much, so many principles that we are encouraged to adhere to before exploring and experimenting further with form line. And I strongly believe, coming from a creative family, that in order to navigate this complex world that we're living in, we have to be extremely creative in order to survive and in order to continue the culture. And practices, creative practices that push boundaries where you are risking failing, are essential to getting to where we're going. And so we got to embody that trickster energy.
Yeah, the trickster energy, but also then the safe space to, you know, in that safe space too, where it's like it's okay to try things that maybe aren't going to work out exactly the way you want them to.
Right. Failure doesn't have to be an end point. Failure can be a beginning point. Failure can be the point at which, you know, you find an idea that takes you into a different future.
Yeah. Yeah. This is a totally random thought related to this, but I play a lot of like role-playing RPGs and stuff, and failure in an RPG can sometimes actually lead you to a whole new world, a whole new story, a whole new adventure that you wouldn't have gone on because you think, oh, I got to get this right, right? I have to make this right choice. There is no right choice, right? There's expression and there's creativity and there's exploration. And that's what this show seems like it's going to be about. How long will the show be up for?
The show is slated to be taken down on May 8th.
Okay, so it'll be up for a couple months. Mm-hmm. Okay, just in case you can't make the opening reception next week, you can still get down there to On Hit and look at this artwork and support it, I'm sure, as well.
Yes, and I do want to answer that question you said, what can they expect to see?
Which
Maybe some stuff that they won't like looking at. There is probably going to be some stuff that just is like, I am wanting to walk away right now. And probably some stuff... You're going to see some stuff that moves your heart for sure.
And that's excellent.
Stuff you've never seen before.
I love that. It's going to be so cool. Well, it is the Gestures of Our Rebel Bodies. It's opening next Saturday, January 24th at the On Hit Gallery downtown. And there's going to be a really awesome panel on Thursday, January 22nd from noon to 1:30 p.m. at Sea Alaska Heritage Institute. And that panel will include many of the artists talking about this show and the work that's involved there, which is kind of cool. And Ursula and Kimberly, Gunath Chishawa, for coming in today and sharing with us with a little bit about this awesome show that's going to be coming. I don't know if there's I know in like the theater you say break a leg. Is there anything you say for an art show, like good opening, or what do you say for...
Good luck.
Hope you get your work done before it opens, right? And one of the artists that's involved is Nicholas Galanin. And Nicholas is a Renaissance person, does all kinds of things. And he also has a band called Yahtzeen. And they had a new album that just dropped.
Today.
So on our way out of this interview, I want to play one of the cuts from that new album, and we'll look forward to maybe having Nick in next week to talk about this show as well as his work with Yahtzeen. But I really want to say thank you for coming in and being part of this. It was a pleasure to chat with you both today.
Thank you.
Okay, so we're going to listen to, I think I'm going to pick this song called Twilight. It features Pink Sifu and Sidibe, I think. I don't know exactly how to say that, but this is off the new cut. It's track 2 from the album called Stand on My Shoulders from Yahtzeen, which just dropped today. So here it is from Juno Afternoon. Thank you.
Support from Hanson Gress. Seeking curious people who like technology, network engineering, and customer support. Opportunities for those who thrive on problem solving. Details at hansongress.com/careers.
This is Juno Afternoon from your listener-supported public media station, KTOO. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. Tuesday, January 20th, begins the second session of the 34th Alaska Legislature. What's new, what's hot, and what do we need to know? Well, I'm joined in studio now by Alaska Public Media's Eric Stone to help us understand and comprehend what things look like as it all begins. Gunath Chi, Shwasiti, thanks for coming in, Eric.
So glad to be here to talk about what's new and what's hot. I love it.
What's new, what's hot? First of all, explain to me, just because I'm kind of slow this way, but what is the second session of the 34th Alaska Legislature? What does all that gobbledygook mean?
It is extremely simple. This is we have a legislative session every year, but we count our legislatures on election cycles. So this is the second year since the 2024 election. So this is the second session of the 34th Alaska Legislature. Basically, every 2 years, they restart. So like in 2027, we will have the 35th Alaska Legislature. It's like,
why did they do it that way?
You know, that's a great question. I imagine it has to do with aligning election cycles. You want stuff to, you know, some stuff takes longer than a year to fully develop. You might have a bill introduced in the first session of the 34th Alaska Legislature, but then it takes some time. You got to figure out we didn't realize it was going to do this, or we didn't realize it had this potential downside, or there's a different way we can improve it. So it can be nice to come back for the second session and sort of work out those kinks and figure out what needs to happen before move it into law or pass it into law.
So you're saying that sometimes there can be bills or whatever is going on started in the first session that don't actually get finished until the second session?
Yeah, I'd say the vast majority of the bills that will be available for lawmakers to work on this session were introduced last year.
Oh, okay.
Obviously we have had several, we've had a couple dozen bills, I think, introduced before this session. They're, well, not introduced yet, but they have been pre-filed. So we'll see some new bills. But I think a lot of what we're going to see this year will be some sort of familiar themes. I think that there is a lot to follow up on from last year. And there, is a big challenge ahead, especially with the state budget.
Okay, so let's first get one thing out of the way. Will there be a PFD argument all session as usual?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah.
And is there anything specific about it this year that's different from previous years?
Well, the state is coming into it. Last year was a really tough budget year. This year is expected to be about as tough, if maybe even tougher. I was speaking with a Republican representative on the House Finance Committee today, Will Stapp, and he told me, with the way expenses and revenues are right now, I don't see how we get to 1,000 without pulling from savings. Last year, they were able to get to 1,000 and have a very small surplus that has, since more or less evaporated. It's going to be a tough year. $1,000 is not a crazy expectation. It may be sort of on the high end, but it's an election year, so those tend to push the PFDs up. We'll see how it goes.
Interesting. Okay. So you're mentioning the tight budget. Is there other things around the budget that people should be aware of or be looking for in the news?
Well, I think a lot of what you're going to see this session are just debates on how to solve this long-running budget issue. For many years, Alaska has struggled to make its revenues meet its expenses, or its expenses to meet its revenues, depending on who you're talking to. And like we're kind of coming to a head. We're not sort of on the edge of insolvency or anything like that, you know. But the state savings accounts are running pretty low, and say if you just pass the governor's budget as written, you'd draw more than half of it out of there. That would have been the case last year, too, and they wound up paring back the PFD mostly and some other departments to avoid that. But yeah, I mean, like figuring out how to increase revenue and decrease expenses is going to be a big focus of the session, and I think we're going to see a lot of that with – I mean, like – Governor Mike Dunleavy has said he's going to introduce this fiscal plan. We don't know what's in it, but you can sort of read the tea leaves and expect that there will probably be something that raises revenue while also, you know, something else that constrains spending. And there will also be probably, I would expect, efforts to address the long-term value of the PFD so that we don't have to have these fights all the time. We haven't seen the plan yet. We don't know when he's going to introduce it, but that's what we're looking out for.
Is there any plan? You mentioned Dunleavy makes me think about like he's on the way out skis here soon. Mm. Is there anything that he's planning to do that you know of at this point before he? Is there something he wants to accomplish in this particular legislative session that he wants to get done before he leaves office?
Yeah, I really think he would like to say he left office and. Helped solve this long-running fiscal issue. He came into office in 2018 with, you know, facing a similar budget crisis, and he's spent basically his whole two terms, these past 8 years, trying to solve those budget issues. The amount of time that he spent seriously addressing the budget issue is debatable. You hear, you know, some folks say that he's not as engaged as he should be. Mm. But, you know, I don't think he would say that. I think he'd say, this is something I've been trying to do for my entire term. We had, you know, special sessions. We had, you know, there was a bipartisan group of lawmakers that tried to work on this. And I think he just wants to, you know, get it done before his term ends. I think that's like one sort of... I think he would feel pretty good about having that issue solved before he leaves office. But that is a very tall order.
It seems like the forever issue, right, for most places. I know the city of Juneau is also going to be dealing with this. And everybody personally is dealing with it too, budgets and expenses and revenues, right?
Like, that's right.
How do you manage that in your own life? How does the state manage it? How does the city manage it? All right, last question for you. Is there any... In these pre-filed bills, it's just to get the information out there a little bit. Is there anything that you're tracking that perked your ears and, oh, that's new or that's interesting, we should be looking at that?
Well, this wasn't a pre-filed bill, but it is a series of bills that I think will be important and make for some interesting debate. And that is you might have heard of this Rural Health Transformation Program, basically in President Trump's tax and spending cut law passed last summer. There was this mechanism to send $50 billion to states to improve rural health care. Alaska is getting $273 million, or about $273 million a year for 5 years. The thing is, when they submitted their application, they said, you know, we're going to do X, Y, and Z. We are going to enter into license compacts, basically like if you have a license in one state, you can practice in Alaska for nurses, for, you know, EMS workers, for a few other things like physician assistants. There's this, that sort of compact and license reciprocity. That'll be a really interesting debate I'm hearing because, like, it's not something that is that neatly maps onto caucus lines. So you might see, you know, people in the majority and the minority working together. You might see conflict within the majority. But like, this is all very high stakes because $1.3 billion to reinvent Alaska's healthcare system is a lot of money. It's a big opportunity. And so the stakes are going to be pretty high on that. So healthcare will be an interesting issue to watch this session.
Awesome. Eric Stone, Alaska Public Media. You can follow his coverage at alaskapublic.org, also on kto.org. We publish most of Eric's articles because it has to do with everything going on here in Juneau as well. I really appreciate you coming in and sharing a little bit of a preview of what's going on this year.
Thank you very much, Boston.
Gwyneth Cheesh. And in addition to Eric's coverage, we also have Mike Lane, who is meeting with and talking with and interviewing each of the delegation from Juno. The series started this week with Mike's conversation with Jesse Kiel, Senator Jesse Kiel. We'll start with that conversation. You can tune into Morning Edition early next week for editions with Sarah Hannon and Andy Story. This is Juno Afternoon on KTOO. Here's that interview with Mike Lane.
We're in the studio with Senator Jesse Kiel. Welcome, Senator.
Well, thank you.
How are you feeling about going into the second regular session?
I'm excited to have everybody come back to the capital city. It's always good to have colleagues from around the state gather at the capital and get to work. And also, you know, catch up a little bit. Some of these folks are even friends.
Is there anything that you're looking forward to or not looking forward to in this particular session?
Well, I think the biggest question is going to be what issues catch fire and get the most traction. Crucially, the thing you always have to do has got to be a budget, right? The Constitution limits us to 1 year at a time, gives us some duties, public safety, public health, managing our resources, education, a couple other things. And so we have to pass and fund a budget. And one thing I'm not looking forward to is making that balance. That's going to be, without a doubt, one of the biggest and most difficult issues in front of the legislature this year. That's not new. The governor, who has for all of his term stood squarely in the way of any kind of fiscal plan with a reasonable possibility of happening, has said that this year he's proposing one. If the governor proposes something that is serious, if the governor proposes something that has a kerosene snowball's chance in Hades of passing, then that will be, I think, the primary issue of the session. If it's something that can't get the votes, won't get the votes, Alaskans aren't going to support, then we won't probably spend huge amounts of time and effort on that. I'm a fiscal plan guy. We need to stabilize the state's resources, stabilize the state's ability to do the basic things we all need a government to do, infrastructure, safety, education, right, et cetera. Can't do them on your own. And so we have a structural deficit. And with the price of oil down and looking to maybe go down further, balancing the books is going to be really brutal this year without some revenue.
With that said, are there any other pressing or urgent issues that you believe are being overlooked at this time?
Well, I don't know about overlooked, right? The other thing that has the potential to take a huge amount of time is this this 50-year dream of a gas line. And if that project gets cash or customers, if it's got customers with a balance sheet who will sign on the line, yes, I'm in to buy gas that comes through this pipeline. Well, then we have some very serious and major issues as a legislature that we're going to have to work on to make sure that gas line can happen.
All right, fair enough. And we touched very briefly on the budget. Where do you believe cuts are necessary?
We have done a lot of cutting already. We have done a huge amount. And so we are always looking at the most efficient way to deliver government services. But Alaskans, by and large, want the services the state provides. It just comes down to that. So we're going to dig in. We're going to get down to the nitty-gritty and talk to everybody and figure out what is the more effective, efficient way to deliver that necessary government service. What's the most efficient, effective way to do that? We're talking about saving tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of dollars a year max. And that counts. We're going to work on it. But it's not hundreds of millions of dollars. It's not a budget deficit. And so we will always do those things because we always need to do the best we can for Alaskans. But that's not going to solve our budget issue.
My last question, how can Alaska secure the PFD for the next 5 to 10 years?
Fundamentally, the most important thing we're going to need is some additional revenue. With a moderate new revenue stream, or probably it's a couple of little streams, right, that come together to a moderate amount, we can stabilize. We can provide public safety, good education, infrastructure. We can run roads and ferries and airports. Do the things that the Constitution requires us to do, that Alaskans need us to do, and still have a PFD going forward.
And Senator, is there anything I didn't ask you that you'd like to touch on?
I'll just say, it is such a privilege to represent the capital city. This town welcomes legislators, welcomes staff from all over the state. Agree with them, disagree with them. They're here serving the public. They're serving their constituents. They're here to do a job for all of Alaska. And I'm always proud of the capital city welcoming my colleagues from around the state. I'm looking forward to that happening again this year. It's going to be a hard session. I hope it's a productive one.
It is the second regular session of the 34th Alaska Legislature. It begins Tuesday, the 20th of January. Senator, thanks for joining me.
Thanks so much for having me.
Support for Juno Afternoon comes from Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, providing Juno with locally roasted coffee for over 40 years, with cafes and drive-through locations throughout Juno. More at heritagecoffee.com.
Listening to Juno Afternoon from Studio 2K at KTOO. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. You can also join us on our live stream on KTOO's YouTube and Facebook pages. That was a little bit of some marimba and no, that's not the marimba.
That's the mbira.
That's the mbira, right? Yeah, I remember last time you were here and I had such a hard time pronouncing it.
Yes.
That's the mbira. The instrument that you were playing.
It's called the hosho.
The hosho. Okay. Yeah. But it's all part of the marimba workshop, right? Or is this a whole, it's like...
It's all related. I'd say it's all related.
Yeah. A little closer to that one there.
Yeah, yeah. So it's all Zimbabwean music and we're teaching marimba music. But marimba music kind of has a natural path from the mbira, historically
speaking.
Okay,
so maybe instead of a marimba intensive, it's a Zimbabwe music intensive.
Yeah, I would say so.
Yeah. Yeah, we're not going to be teaching mbira at the intensive this weekend, but it's going to be performed at the show on Sunday.
Yeah.
I see. Okay. So, well, let's reset here. Let me tell you who I have in the studio with me who was performing. That's Caden Davis. Gunath Cheesh, Caden, welcome in. Thank you so much.
You
and also Jesse Larson. Hi, Jesse. Gunath Cheesh, Wasiti. How are you?
Good.
And then, of course, we have Betsy Sims, who is the mastermind behind all of this. Runs in Juzu marimbas here in town, and people just love in Juzu, and it's taken over Juno. Like, there's how many members do you have now? You have like 150?
No. There's about 15 people who are regular players.
Okay.
And then we have lots of workshops and stuff when people come in.
Yeah, and I know Mike Sabanda's been here. You've had a bunch of different people. This is your second time coming back?
That's right, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you were here, was it last year sometime?
I was here for Folk Fest. I guess this is my third time in Juneau. Yeah. I was here for Folk Fest, and then we did like a house show in July, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I see. Okay. Yeah. So now let's talk with about this workshop that's happening. Betsy tells me that there is one spot left. It starts in like an hour and a half, though. So if you're listening and you want to be part of this workshop, you got to email Betsy like right now. JunoMarimbas@gmail.com is where you could email Betsy if you want to try to get in on this. This is like a 3-day workshop y'all are doing?
Yeah.
So, Betsy, how did this come about?
Well, this is actually Jesse and Caden's baby. I'm just kind of facilitating from here. So if you guys want to
Okay. So why did you want to bring this to Juno?
Well, mostly, I mean, Caden and I love teaching together, and I've been coming and teaching in Juno for years, and I love teaching in these kind of, like, intensive formats because it really lets you dig into the music a lot more, and so we're going to be having 3 separate groups. Everybody's going to be meeting up tonight and learning a song all together, and then over the next 2 days, Saturday and Sunday, we're going to be splitting off and learning a couple songs per group. And then performing it on Sunday. And it's just fun and exciting and interesting to, like, try to throw a bunch of stuff together and then perform it. And it just makes it, I don't know, it's a fun way to learn. And so.
So the people who will be involved in the workshop will also be performing in the show on Sunday. There's a public performance. If you can't make the workshop, there's a public performance this Sunday night, January 18th. It's at Perseverance Theater on their main stage at 7 o'clock. And it's a $20 suggested donation, but it's pay as you can, $20 suggested. And it's going to be a benefit for the Tsioro Art Center in Zimbabwe. Tell me a little bit about your connection to that.
Sure, yeah. So Tsioro Arts is an organization run by the Mafalani family. And the Mafalani family is like very prominent in the Zimbabwean music scene. Jacob and his late wife, Martha, started Tsioro Arts, and they basically provide free music and cultural education to, like, students in the community. And they do that through playing marimbas. Jacob's a master musician, and all of his kids are also amazing musicians, and Martha was an amazing musician. And he builds marimbas, and they teach the kids in the neighborhood how to play. And this is in a really, really impoverished part of Zimbabwe, and so there's a lot of, like, issues going on right now with, like, drug epidemics, like, on the streets in these areas, and this is a way to get kids, like, out of those situations and, like, into a place where they can connect with, like, their culture, which isn't really something that's being taught in a lot of, like, schools and whatnot in Zimbabwe. So they're really good at getting these kids to, like, know their, you know, their history as Zimbabweans. And by way of traditional music, it's a beautiful thing that they have going on. And so we know the Mafalinis because Jacob and his family have been to the States a lot of times to teach workshops and play. And we got to visit Zimbabwe this last summer, and we spent some time with the kids at Tsioro and with the Mafalini family. And they're just wonderful. So we just decided to support their cause through this concert.
Awesome. And if you want to learn more about Tsioro Arts, you can go to tsoroarts.org. That's tsoroarts.org. It has pictures, shows you kind of the work they do, talks a little bit about what else is going on there. And I think Jacob is the one who, he travels around the States with his family and plays, right? Don't they all, play?
They all have come, at points. Yeah,
that's kind of really, that's really awesome.
Yeah.
And I may have asked you this last time, but I'm so curious, I'm going to ask it again. How did you two get involved in Zimbabwean music? Let's start with you, Jesse.
Yeah, I grew up in Colorado, and in Boulder, there's like a really big Zimbabwean music scene from a center called the Kutandara Center, and that's actually how I first came to Juno is... my band came up and performed and taught for a week when I was like 16 years old, and I've been just like coming up since then. So there's like pockets of this music all over the U.S., and Juno's lucky enough to like have one of those pockets, and so Boulder was also one of those places. So that's where I grew up, and I have been playing since then.
And so it was just part of the culture of where you were growing up.
Yeah, I just kind of wound up like going to a class at this studio and immediately like falling in love with it, and then just like that all I wanted to do was play from there on out. And that's I think what happens to a lot of people with this music is they like try it one
can't
time
relate.
And then you can't stop. And
well, it's sort of like, I mean, we've had it over the last few years, Betsy's, we've had 2 or 3, 4 or 5 people come in and play and do things, and you can't help but move, right? Mm-hmm. You can't help but move and just sort
Absolutely.
Of get into your into your soul, really. Caden, how about you? How did it start for you?
Yeah, one of those pockets of Zimbabwean music aficionados are actually in my hometown of Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, which is not a place you'd usually expect to be finding Zimbabwean music. But yeah, there's just like people who learned this music in the 80s and 90s who fell in love with it and wrote grants to get instruments built and would just like teach what they learned from like workshops with like the first Zimbabweans who were here.
I see.
And so that's like Randy and Amy in Boulder, like got into playing Zimbabwean music in the 90s, I think, like, and started a center. There was a lady, Tina Gospodinetich in Coeur d'Alene, who took a workshop with Dumi Sani Madaida in the 1980s. Not the 1880s, in the 1980s, and like it just stuck, and now there's like marimba in Idaho.
So wow, it's really that's random. So funny.
But I mean, we both started when we were kids and just like played in youth bands growing up, and now we've played in a couple different bands together.
Part of your whole existence. And Betsy, how did Njuzu start? How did you begin that journey with Njuzu marimbas?
Well, Annie Gazelle got the marimbas here.
Okay.
When the canvas opened up.
Mm.
She's the one who had them built, a whole set, which actually the person who built them said that never in all of his history of doing marimbas had anybody ever ordered a set.
Oh, wow.
They ordered like an instrument and then another instrument, but he built a full set and sent them up here. And then we just fell in love with them.
Yeah, because you all have like the different sizes. You got
which
that
is
giant
normal.
One, and you got, yeah.
With them, like Western marimbas, one person can play like 8 octaves on an instrument. But with these, it's all spread out between there's sopranos and tenors and bass and baritone. So it kind of takes a village to play, which is, I think, maybe why they're popular in Juno, because it's very cooperative,
very community centered.
Yeah, and nobody's the star.
Yeah.
It's like everybody's part matters as much as everybody else's part. And I just love that. I love that part.
I mean, I remember the last time I saw it and I was just like, especially the people on the giant one.
Yep. The bass is awesome.
That's a workout, man.
It
that's
is.
A
oh, yeah,
workout.
Definitely. I call it marimba size. It really is. On some, you're sweating.
Yeah. And so also for future events, Betsy, the best place for people to get information on future events is to email that junomarimbas@gmail.com, right? And get on your list.
Yep. Yep. And I have a whole mailing list. So.
Yeah, because then you let people know when these workshops are coming, when these concerts are coming. And so, again, this concert is on Sunday night at Perseverance Main Stage. It's at 7 p.m. It's going to be the culmination of the workshop that's happening. We have a couple minutes left, and so I wanted to have you two talk about, again, these two instruments that you have. Can you pick them up and show me them a little bit?
Definitely.
And because I know that you're going to teach. Are you teaching these?
We're going to have some people playing these. These are just, you know, this is played. Hosho are played with
Hosho.
Like, Hosho,
how
yeah.
do you spell that?
H-O-S-H-O.
S-H-O. Oh, say that
H-O-S-H-O.
One more.
Yeah. So we'll have these in all of the songs, and like they go with Mbira and marimba. And
where do those come from? Like, how did the, yeah, tell me the history.
I mean, these are just like a Zimbabwean instrument, and it's literally just a gourd that's grown and then dried out and then hollowed out, and there's hota seeds inside. Normally, sometimes there's popcorn seeds too on the inside, and there's a couple different patterns that you play depending on the type of song that you're playing.
Yeah.
And I mean, they're just like the timekeeper the whole time. They just are like,
they're really
going.
Important.
Yeah, so they're very
it's important. Also so very hard.
It's very, Jesse's really very hard.
So like you're saying like the because you're like the timekeeper because there's so many people playing and they're listening for this to keep the beat basically.
Hopefully they're listening.
Right. That's what you're teaching them. So do you teach people these or are these more
sometimes, yeah. We probably won't dig into these too much this weekend except for maybe some of the more advanced people who are gonna be doing the workshop because they're way trickier than they look.
It's not just shaking it like that.
It's not as easy as it looks.
Yeah, that's so interesting. And
way
then this,
harder than playing marimbas.
Yeah, and then the mbira, tell me about this instrument.
Yeah, so this is an mbira nare or zavadzimu, depending on who you ask. It's about 1,000 years old, like as an instrument, they think. It's from Zimbabwe, from the Shona people in Zimbabwe. They typically are like used in ceremony, like traditionally in Shona culture, but it was pushed out of society in the colonial period, in the like late 1800s through 1980, when Zimbabwe became independent, this instrument was like pushed out, attempted to be pushed out of culture.
So that's the actual instrument, right? And then, then the case is more for resonance.
Yep, yep. So this is called a deze. They're usually made of gourds. This one's fiberglass because gourds break really easily. And I flew here from Washington, and so it's. I mean, it's a lot quieter without the gourd.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah. And are you teaching that this weekend?
We won't be teaching any mbira, but we will be playing some at the concert.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Great. Yeah. So what's going to be taught this weekend in terms of the instruments that
marimba.
You're playing? Marimba.
We'll be playing marimba, and the marimba like ensemble. So it's an 8-piece ensemble. Like Betsy said, there's sopranos, altos, tenors, baritone, and bass. And like I said, the bass is really fun. It's giant.
Yeah.
It is fun to watch.
I definitely see that and I go, I want to get my hands on that. But then I know I'm going to be sweating and all that kind of stuff.
Definitely.
Again, you can get on Betsy's list, junomarimbas@gmail.com. You can head over to Perseverance Theater on Sunday night at 7 p.m. It's all a benefit for the Theoro Arts Center in Zimbabwe. And you can learn this weekend. There's one spot left if you can get in. Caden Davis, Jesse Larson, Betsy Sims, Gunnath Cheesh for being here today and telling us all about it and give us a little preview of some music. I really appreciate that.
Thanks, Boston.
Thanks for having us.
Gunnath Cheesh. All right, that's going to do it for today's Juno Afternoon. Juno Afternoon airs Wednesday through Friday at 3 p.m. right here on KTO Juno 104.3. And KAUK Juno Auk Bay 91.7. Hello, out the road. You can find the show online at ktoo.org/JunoAfternoon. You can also find live stream archives on KTOO's YouTube page. I'm Boston Christopher, producer and host of the program, with help today from Aaron Tripp. Gunnath Cheesh, have a fantastic holiday weekend.